This is Macro Voices with Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 357 was produced on January 5th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. 42 Macro founder Darius Dale returns as our first guest of 2023. Darius was one of the very first people I interviewed in January 2022, when the S&P was just under 4,800 and everyone was buying the dip. Darius told us 1 year ago that 2022 could be a crash year for the stock market, and needless to say, he got the bear call right. We'll discuss his current outlook for economic cycles, stocks, and commodities, including gold. I'm pleased to announce another project I've been working on for the last few months. That project is a documentary series I hope will eventually air on Netflix or another major streaming service. The subject is the coming global energy crisis, why it's too late to avoid it, what caused it, and what it will take to solve it. The idea is that while most people outside of Europe don't even think there is any energy crisis yet, I predict that that will have become resoundingly clear to them before I can produce a full documentary series and get it released on a major streaming service. I'm going to pre-release the first draft of my narration script for the new docuseries in podcast form as a series of 5 one-hour-long podcast episodes to air here on the Macro Voices feed for the next 5 Sundays. The goal is to solicit feedback and critique from the Macro Voices community so that I can perfect the message before spending money making a documentary out of it. So stay tuned to your podcast app for those special episodes starting this coming Sunday, January 8th, since we won't be sending a separate email message announcing them.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Darius, when Eric, Nick, and I will discuss the charts in the S&P 500, NASDAQ, gold, and oil. Eric, before we move on to the feature interview with Darius, let's cover the crude oil markets.
EIA inventory was delayed this week due to the holiday and wasn't available at the time of recording. Needless to say, we're off to a horrible start for the year with WTI crude oil down 10% in the first 2 days of trading. It's bouncing pretty vigorously off of the European Open early Thursday morning. Question will be whether that holds for the rest of the day. And I'm not surprised that we saw this really big sell-off, because even though the China reopening news had helped a rally in the flat price, time spreads have remained lackluster at best, with the first 4 months of the WTI curve still in contango. For whatever reason, this market is far more focused on recession concerns than it is on supply. I think that the China COVID data is being misinterpreted a little bit. It seems like people are freaking out because of all of the news out of China about really big outbreaks of COVID, but they're really big outbreaks of Omicron. There haven't been nearly as many deaths as there were in the original outbreaks in China, and I think that everybody's kind of panicking, saying, oh my gosh, it's the same thing all over again. And it's not the same thing. This is what was intended when they made the decision to reopen their economy, relax the zero COVID restrictions, and allow this to burn through. And needless to say, if you're sick and you're in China, you know, that's obviously not a good situation. But in terms of market signals and what it's telling us, it means that they're serious about reopening the Chinese economy, and they're not going to let COVID hold them back. So although this will result in significant outbreaks of Omicron, as are already occurring in China, I don't think it should be interpreted as being bearish for markets, which is the way that some people are interpreting it. I still hold the view that 2023 is likely to be a significant up year for crude oil. And the reason for that is both that we're out of spare capacity and we're out of commercial and strategic inventory. So we really are in a situation where supply is constrained and unable to grow. China is going to reopen. We are eventually going to press up against limitations of supply, and we don't have any spare capacity or inventory to buffer it. But for whatever reason, the market is focused on economic signals about recession, and the front of the WTI curve, still in contango, is a sign that it's not going to let up anytime soon. It doesn't really make sense to me that the fundamentals around supply are being so completely ignored and that all of the focus is on recession concerns, but that seems to be what's driving the market. I just want to make clear, though, that the world literally cannot live without Russian oil now. There's not enough spare capacity in the rest of the world combined to make up for it if even half of Russian oil were taken off the market. So let's hope that we don't have any geopolitical outcome that would result in Russian oil coming off the market for any reason.
Now, this week's feature interview guest is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Eric, why did we get Darius back on the show this week?
Well, I wanted to make Darius the first guest this year because he nailed the call so beautifully when we had him on in early January last year. But also, I wanted to know if the crash he predicted last year has already happened to his thinking, because to my thinking, there really hasn't been a crash. If anything, what we've had is an astonishingly orderly bear market that really hasn't had any signs of panic in it. So I'm not sure that this is over. I don't think it's over. I want to find out if Darius thinks it's over, and I want to find out whether or not he still sees a crash on the horizon. And of course, the final reason is Darius's chart books are just so rich and full of data that I love getting an update from him and seeing the latest incarnation of all of his beautiful charts.
Well, Eric's interview with Darius Dale is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Darius prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. I encourage you to download it, as we will be making extensive references to it throughout our discussion. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button above Darius's picture that says looking for the downloads. Darius, I really want to give you credit. We had you as one of our very first guests in 2022 on this program. At the time, the stock market, S&P, was, I think, just barely below 4,800. Everybody was talking about buying the dip and, you know, market can't go any higher. You came out in January of 2022 and said, hey, I think it could be a crash year for the stock market. Things are not as good as everybody thinks. Clearly, you got the gist of that call right, because it was a big down year and it surprised a lot of people. But the question on my mind is, it seems to me, Darius, you used the word crash specifically, and I felt like that big, huge bear market that we had never really had a panic moment. So has the crash already happened, or is it maybe still yet to come?
Oh, well, thanks again for having me back on the show, Eric, and I appreciate the very kind words. I mean, you know, it's I think we did do a good job of helping prepare investors for the difficult bear market that we experienced in 2022. I did an okay job trading it. I think I lost 334 basis points in my capital trading it. Should have been up. with the crash call in January, definitely should have made money, but that just goes to show you how tough these bear markets are.
Darius, how far into this story are we? Is the bear market over? Have we seen the bottom, or is this just the warm-up?
Great question, Eric. It's our belief that we have not seen the ultimate lows of this bear market. In terms of how we've characterized it with our clients at 42 Macro, bear markets, particularly those that are associated with recessions, when you go back and study economic history, they tend to come in two phases. There's always the liquidity, the phase one liquidity cycle downturn. That's where the Fed's, taking away the punch bowl, valuations are getting pressured, et cetera, et cetera. There's always a credit cycle. And so we're still waiting the phase two credit cycle portion that we just unfortunately have yet to see. I prepared a fantastic slide deck for your listeners. And by the way, Happy New Year and blessings to the whole Macro Voices community. If we want to jump to slide 66 in that presentation, I can give you an indication of what we mean by the fact that we have yet to see the phase two credit cycle downturn portion priced in. On this slide, we show four different measures of financial risk, with the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index in the top panel, investment grade credit spreads in the second panel, high yield credit spreads in the third panel, and then the high beta, low beta ratio amongst S&P 500 companies in the fourth panel. And as you can see, the dotted lines in this chart correspond to the peak and or trough of the particular indicator in each of the last two recessions. The green line is 2001 recession, the orange line is the 1990-1991 recession, and the red line is the GFC peak or trough. And the reason they're green, orange, and red is because there are three different styles of recession. One was, the green one was obviously the shallowest recession in U.S. economic history. The orange line is the 1991 recession, kind of an energy-driven recession. And then lastly, obviously, the GFC, one of the deepest recessions we've seen in U.S. recorded U.S. economic history. And oh, by the way, the blue line is the mean of each of those dotted lines. And as you can see, financial conditions, investment credit spreads, high yield credit spreads, and then ultimately, the relationship between high beta stocks and low beta stocks are all shy of the levels that they traditionally have gone to in each of these very different, very disparate recessions. And so ultimately, it's our belief that the credit cycle has yet to be priced in, and really, quite frankly, has yet to be seriously entertained by asset markets.
Darius, let's talk about the economy and recession next, because when we spoke a year ago, you were one of very few people even talking about a bear market. These days, almost everybody is predicting a recession in the first half of 2023. I have to agree with them, but it scares me that so many of them suddenly agree with me. It makes me wonder if I've got it wrong. What do you think?
Great question, Eric. So, it's our belief that we would take the other side of that. If we have sort of three core beliefs here at 42 Macro that we've been espousing in our research to our customers, I would say it's number one is that the U.S. economy is more resilient than the average investor realizes and is unlikely to enter a recession until the back half of the year at the earliest, could be as late as Q4 of 23 or Q1 of next year. Number two, as a function of that core belief, the Fed will likely tighten more than what is currently priced into the market and be uncharacteristically reluctant to ease on the back end. And then number three, as a function of number two, the Fed tightening more and being reluctant to ease when they need to ease, it will likely cause the downturn, which will be, in our opinion, mostly timed in late 23 and in the early part of 2024. It'll likely cause that downturn to be worse than otherwise than consensus expects. There's this kind of immaculately mild recession view that has very quickly become investor consensus, and it's our belief that if the Fed stays at this for longer than they otherwise should be, then ultimately it's not going to be mild. It's probably going to be something that looks a little bit more moderate, which makes a lot of sense in the context of the inflation pressures that we're dealing with in the U.S. economy. If we can just go to one slide on the inflation side, we continue to see, through the vis-a-vis underlying measures of inflation on slide 14, median CPI, trend mean CPI, median PC inflation, trim mean PC inflation, and then ultimately Powell's current favorite indicator. He's quite promiscuous, by the way. He's had several favorite indicators throughout the past, 6 to 9 months. But his current girlfriend right now is core services PCE, ex shelter, ex housing. And as you can see on the slide here, slide 14, all five of these indicators is currently compounding on a 3-month annualized rate of change basis higher than the Fed funds rate. So at a bare minimum, we got to get all these levels below the Fed funds rate in the context of their, what I believe to be a hawkish Fed pivot that we observed in December 14th at that FOMC. The Fed upgraded the labor market in lieu of inflation and its reaction function, which was a hawkish pivot in our belief because the labor market is likely to remain more resilient than inflation over the medium term. And then secondarily, there was a lot of cohesion with respect to the dot plot and a lot of, you know, I guess, you know, kind of sincerity with respect to their economic projections, which in our opinion accomplishes two things from a reaction function perspective. One, it signals that, you know, the Fed's will be very reluctant to ease because there's so many sort of, you know, there won't be as many disparate views amongst the committee members as the going starts to get tough from a labor market perspective. But secondarily, they're being quite serious about their economic forecast. If you jump to slide 64 in this presentation, got a couple slides on their forecast here that I think are very instructive for investors. You know, the Fed is calling for core PCE to end the year of 2023 at 3.5%. We've never seen core PCE decline 120 basis points, which is what it would have to decline by the end of, from now, from the latest print to you know, to get to that level by the end of next year over a 13-month time frame without an actual recession. So that's step one. So the Fed is already implicitly implying that, hey, look, we're going to have to do enough to get inflation down, which ultimately may cause a recession. But then number two, they're being very explicit, in my opinion, about, you know, their unwillingness to ease next year. And this is really vis-a-vis a function of their unemployment forecast. You know, the Fed is calling for U3, the headline unemployment rate, to rise to 4.6% by the end of next year. That has never happened. We've never seen a 90 basis point increase in the unemployment rate over a 13-month time frame without a recession. And so this is a Federal Reserve that is forecasting recessionary-like conditions in both inflation and in the labor market. And ultimately, it likely means, and I'll shut up and let you ask a question after this, if you go to slide 38 in the presentation, ultimately, it means that this is a Federal Reserve that is going to be aggressively pushing back against market expectations for easing monetary conditions all year. Right now, there's, you know, three rate hikes priced in, getting to a terminal Fed funds rate of 5.25% if you look at Fed funds futures, you know, by March of this year. And ultimately, the market is currently pricing the Fed to do an about face and pivot as quickly as July, and ultimately another rate cut in December of this year. So in our opinion, at the bare minimum, those two back half rate cuts are not going to come to fruition, which ultimately means the Fed's going to hike 50 basis points more relative to market implied expectations than what's currently priced in. And ultimately, I'm not so sure, just given the dynamics in the labor market, that they're going to be able to stop at 5.25%. It may be the case that this is a Fed that has to get to 550 or 575 ultimately to start to see some real movement and you know, some of these core measures of wages and income.
Darius, I want to go back to the three main points that you made a minute ago, because the first one you said is the U.S. economy is probably more resilient than people think. And then the second item that you said is that's going to mean the Fed will tighten more, and that will result eventually in the second half of the year in the recession that everybody's talking about actually happening. But hang on, if I think about investor psychology, I'm having a little bit of trouble reconciling the first two, because when you say the economy is not likely to go into recession as soon as people think it is, normally, at least in the old normal, that would be cause for celebration. That means stocks go up because the economy didn't go into recession like people expected. But wait a minute, number two was that causes the Fed to tighten more. That's more of a stocks go down story. So which one wins that tug of war, and what should we expect in the first half before we get to the second half when the recession actually happens?
Yeah, phenomenal question. I'll sort of unpack the various components of that question, you know, because I think it's important to kind of lay the groundwork before I, you know, ultimately give you the punchline. So just starting with the groundwork, you know, we kind of left off heading to slide 20, where we show, you know, the demand for labor in the U.S. economy through a couple of different metrics. The chart on the left on slide 20 here shows the, you know, what we call private sector labor income, which is the productization of the growth rate and payrolls. And we take the mean of the household and establishment surveys to give the nod to the kind of the recessionista community that continues to anchor on the household survey, you know, showing, you know, kind of tepid employment growth, if not declining employment growth since March of last year. Then obviously you have hourly earnings, you know, ratcheting up on a 3-month annualized basis, 6.2%. And ultimately that the combination of that aggressive growth rate in earnings and, you know, some growth in payrolls, when you take the mean of those two surveys, you're talking about private sector labor income on a 3-month annualized basis in November growing at 6.6%. You know, that's 50% higher than the pre-COVID trend. So the Fed's got a lot of hay to bale in terms of creating slack in the labor market through that metric. If you don't believe that metric, because again, that's a 42 macro metric, just made it up, you know, the good econometrician that I am, we actually get data straight from the government in terms of nominal employee compensation via the BEA in the PCE report that we get at the end of every month. And as you can see in the chart on the right, the first cluster of bars, we show the three-month annualized rate of change of nominal employee compensation. Again, these are November figures, accelerated to 6.1%. So, you know, whether you believe 6.6 or 6.1, the reality is neither of those numbers is consistent with the pre-COVID trend. And more importantly, you know, running at about 50% higher than the rate that is consistent with the, you know, kind of with what the Fed needs to see from a reaction functions perspective to not cause itself to tighten well into 2023 and ultimately more than consensus expectations. There's a second component of this sort of discussion that I think is important to highlight, which is ultimately the balance sheet side of the equation. So actually, before we get to the balance sheet side of the equation, I'll just quickly touch on the yield curve and where a lot of this information, a lot of this kind of thought process started to originate for me and for our customers. On slide 24, we show the three-month 10-year yield curve, which only recently inverted in late October. When you look at slide 25 and you do the math on yield curve inversions vis-a-vis the business cycle, what we find is that, you know, on a 0 to 6 month forward interval basis, there's a 0% chance of being in recession from the inversion of the yield curve, at least going back to the eight cycles that we have of this particular indicator, which I believe to be the best recession indicator. It's been proven empirically that it's actually the best recession indicator, and it's usually the biggest dominant feature in most recession probability models. 6 to 12 months forward, there's only a 25% chance of recession. You actually have to go into the 12 to 18 months forward interval to get to see the percent positive, percent negative ratios, you know, flip in a way that is supportive of having a recession as the modal outcome as your baseline probability. And so starting with that and that understanding, you know, we turn to slide 26 where we, you know, just see off the chart strength in the household sector balance sheet in the U.S. economy. This chart has four different panels. The first panel just shows the amount of checkable cash on household balance sheets. And this is checkable cash, so cash in checking accounts and cash in money market funds, not time savings deposits. Those are excluded from this calculation. At $7.9 trillion as of Q3, you know, we're talking about basically a double where that number was prior to the beginning of the pandemic. We're now at 5% at the second panel, 5% as a share of total assets in terms of that checkable cash. So consumers, you know, feel rich and they have a lot of cash on the balance sheet. And you go into the third panel, they don't have a lot of debt on their balance sheet. You know, 101 cents on the dollar in terms of household debt divided by a nominal disposable personal income. You know, this is a consumer that has ample capacity to lever up relative to previous cycles. And then lastly, debt service ratio is, you know, practically an all-time low. Again, the debt service ratio is the share of your income that you spend on amortizing and servicing debt. And so when you put those four pictures together, you wind up with a consumer that has a lot of ability to continue powering forward and spending, particularly as inflation decelerates. You know, this is how you're getting, you know, kind of the improvement in real GDP that we've observed in the second half of this year. And it's not just the household sector, Eric. It's the corporate sector as well. On slide 28, we show those same four metrics for the corporate sector. And, you know, at $2.3 trillion of cash, you know, we're still right around, we're still higher than levels that we entered the pandemic with, you know, just over 4% of total assets. You know, you got to go back to the 1950s to see corporates have this share of their assets in cash. Ultimately, you know, corporate debt, the debt dynamics are not as pristine as the household sector. We're about 49 cents on the dollar in terms of corporate debt. You know, that's more or less at an all-time high if you exclude the kind of the shock we had and when we took GDP down by 20% in the pandemic. But ultimately, debt service is actually quite manageable. When you look at the corporate debt service ratio at only 40.2%, well off, you know, well off levels that have historically coincided with recession. So, you know, that's kind of a long-winded way of saying, hey, look, you know, the economy is going to remain resilient. And as in a function of that resiliency, we go to slide 7, we understand that we're going to still be in this liquidity cycle downturn. This phase one liquidity cycle downturn effectively got extended because of that hawkish Fed pivot that we observed on December 14th. So what I'm showing in this chart is, you know, what has become quite popular across Wall Street is our net liquidity model here at 42 Macro you know, the blue line in this chart where we take the Fed's balance sheet, the total assets on the Fed's balance sheet, and then we subtract the Treasury General Account balance and the reverse repo facility balance, what we show in slide 8 there, from that total assets. And it gives us a more approximate feature of the net liquidity function, the dollar net liquidity function out of the U.S. government. And ultimately, we think the blue line of this chart, you know, it's likely to bounce from the kind of the window dressing we observed in late Q4. But ultimately, we still think the blue line in this chart is headed lower, if only because the economy is resilient, because the Fed is going to be doing more tightening, because we're going to continue to see an increase in the reverse repo facility balance as policy rates continue to rise, and we continue to have this sort of, you know, T-bill shortage that is contributing to, you know, effectively reverse repo facility rates being higher than the rates that investors can get in the Treasury market and in other markets, you know, commercial paper, et cetera, et cetera. So ultimately, we just think the blue line on the chart in slide 7 is likely to head lower at least for 1 to 2 more quarters, which again is partially a function of the economy remaining resilient and all those labor market and statistics remaining resilient as well.
Darius, you made me curious on page 24, where you talked about the 3-month, 10-year yield curve. You know, usually when I hear people talking about yield curve inversions relative to recession forecasts, they usually discuss the 2-year, 10-year curve and what that relationship is. And I don't know, maybe 2's 10's just has a much catchier ring to it than 3-month, 10-year. And on Wall Street, sometimes people go with what sounds cool. Seems like you may have deviated from the culture and actually done your homework on what works best. So tell me a little bit more about why you use 3-month 10-year instead of 2-year 10-year yield curve charts in order to time recessions.
Yeah, so I think it's a couple reasons. One just qualitative, another quantitative. So qualitative, you know, this is the yield curve that I want to say Dr. Campbell Harvey over at Research Affiliates and Professor at Duke wrote a white paper on back in the late 80s, I think, or, you know, when he was doing his dissertation. You know, this was the yield curve that was the predictor of recessions. And so I'm not so sure why Wall Street just deviated from that model. But also,
well, you got to admit, 2's 10 sounds a lot cooler than 3-month 10-year.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
In a meeting, trying to impress somebody, it sounds pretty good.
Eric, as a guy who spams customers with jargon all the time, I strive for ways to make my research sound cooler, but ultimately not at the expense of actually having accurate forecasts and ultimately good market calls. So, you know, we focus on the 3-month 10-year because ultimately it's just a more reliable predictor. There's a lot more volatility in yield curve inversions on the 2's 10s, which makes it a less reliable predictor. It's still a good predictor. It's just not as good as the 3-month 10-year. So understanding that, you know, we're going to anchor our models on this particular indicator.
Let's go back to my prior question and try to get to the bottom line there. You're saying recession that most people think is happening in the first half doesn't really happen, but the Fed does tighten more as a result, and that means that the recession does happen in the second half. So I've got the chronology of what you anticipate in terms of recession. Let's translate that to what's the chronology of stock market moves?
Ooh, great question. So, I mean, I think ultimately you have to attack this from a couple lenses, right? So, you know, going back to our net liquidity analysis, ultimately, we think by the end of Q1, we're talking about somewhere around $5.5 trillion in net liquidity. That number could be, you know, closer to 5 by the time you get into the summer months, if we're correct on the resiliency of the economy, particularly the labor market, contributing to a resilient and reluctant Fed reaction function as it relates to tightening. In terms of, you know, the ultimate lows that we likely are likely to see, really trying to determine what that level is, you have to understand it from a couple of lenses. One, the primary lens is understanding the duration of time on the x-axis between the markets pricing in the full brunt of phase one, you know, which is the declining net liquidity function, the hiking of interest rates, and ultimately any dollar strength that results from that, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, the sort of, you know, changes in expectations vis-a-vis the ECB, BOE, et cetera. The time and the distance between that and ultimately the phase two credit cycle portion, which the markets will be anticipatory in pricing in ahead of the actual recession that we're likely to see commence in the second half of the year. If there's a decent amount of time between the end of phase one and phase two, in the beginning of phase two, then it's very likely markets can bottom in, you know, the first part of this year, sometime in Q1, rally into the spring or even into the summer months, and then ultimately puke from there into the back end of the year. If, however, you know, the economy is incrementally resilient, because again, I think the problem right now is the labor market being too strong. And as long as the labor market is growing nominal employee compensation at a 50% level higher than its pre-COVID trend, we have a significant problem from a phase one liquidity cycle problem from a standpoint. So as long as we're still in that phase one liquidity cycle, as long as that goes on, the closer and closer it's going to get to phase two, which in our opinion is going to start sometime in the middle of next year anyway. And so if there's a decent window of time, you know, we could probably rally. Let's say, you know, if we go to slide 39, we did some valuation work to try to get to an ultimate low of this market. I think on slide 39, when you apply a median price to next 12 months earnings ratio to the market, you know, that's probably as low as we're going to get from a phase one standpoint, right around 3,600. You know, I don't really see a fundamental basis for the market to trade significantly lower than that, just purely based on the phase one liquidity cycle portion. However, if we start pricing in phase two, you know, kind of commensurate right around the end or just shortly after the end of the phase one portion of the bear market, then we're going to have a big problem on our hands. This is how you get to, on slide 40, 2,900. If you apply a median stock market capitalization multiple to gross domestic income, that's how you, you know, that's, you're talking 2,900 on the S&P there, 2,800 on slide 41, if you apply a median price to sales multiple to the market. And so ultimately, you know, if we, again, if phase one and phase two are spaced apart, you know, I can see us trading to 3,600, rallying to 4,100, or wherever the 200-day moving average will be at that time, and then ultimately selling off back to 3,600. If, however, the labor market stays too sticky, too hot for too long, then it's ultimately we're going to be tightening into the beginning of the pricing in of phase two, which we talked about earlier in the discussion. And that's how you get to the market really starting to push to new lows into the 29 to 2800 range. So, you know, if that sounds really bearish, you know, I'm trying not to scare your audience, but again, I think it's just prudent to manage risk and understand that these big macro forces, you know, you can try to game them, you can try to trade them, you can, you know, add a flows overlay or technical overlay, but at the end of the day, the markets are going to go where they have to go to price these dynamics in.
Darius, I just want to clarify a point of terminology there. You said in your last answer that we could see a bottom in Q1 and then a rally and then a puke after that. When you said a bottom in Q1, do you mean a bottom like that's the bottom of the bear market? Or do you mean a short-term bottom, then we rally and then you puke to a lower bottom after that?
100%. So great question. So I definitely expect to puke to a lower bottom. So let me further clarify that. I think
so the bottom in Q1 wasn't the bottom. It was a short-term,
correct.
Short-term low. Okay.
Correct. And the reason for that is, again, we think the markets are going to be anticipatory around the Fed pivot, or, you know, what will be perceived to be a Fed pivot, which is them stepping to the sideline in conjunction with the end of that phase one liquidity cycle downturn. If you go to slide 48, you know, our work has shown that, you know, even in recession many times, that the market tends to bottom right around the inflection in the liquidity cycle. And I do believe that markets are going to treat the ultimate inflection in Fed tightening, you know, them getting to their terminal rate, et cetera, as an inflection in the liquidity cycle. It won't be from the perspective of helping the economy, but it will be from the perspective of improving market psychology. So there's an opportunity for markets to rally. You know, let me put a couple headlines. You know, envision the headlines. If we're in, you know, let's call it March of this year, and the labor market is still running hot, the Fed has already guided to a couple more rate hikes by the middle of this year, and maybe, you know, inflation has come down a little bit more, and it's given the Fed confidence that that couple more rate hikes they're guiding to will likely be it, then the market will really start to say, hey, look, there's still probably a credible chance for a soft landing. And oh, by the way, the world's second largest economy is now doing more stuff and traveling more, and, you know, at the bare minimum, in terms of adding an incremental kind of support to the global economy. So I could easily see the market trading off to 3,600 and then trying to rally back to whatever the 200-day moving average would be at that time. That the issue is, again, we have yet to price in the credit cycle feature of this bear market, which ultimately we believe will commence by the middle of this year. If we rally substantially, you know, as a conjunction of the soft landing Fed pivot narrative, then you start the price in phase two from a higher level than 3,600. However, if phase one keeps extending itself into the middle of this year, you're going to start to have to price in phase two from a lower market price. And that is the ultimate risk to the market. That's the big left tail risk, is that the economy stays too resilient for too long and the Fed remains too resilient and too reluctant to pivot. And ultimately, that resiliency and reluctance will ultimately cause, you know, the market to have to price in again phase two from the lows of phase one. That's how you get to below 3,000 on the S&P.
Darius, so far, everything that we've discussed has been, in one form or another, an aspect of cycles, whether it's an economic cycle, a credit cycle, a recession cycle. And you've been just nailing these calls, especially through last year. But hang on, it seems to me like on top of that, we need to overlay a thematic conversation, which is for decades now, we've been in a globalized unipolar economy. And now with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, it seems like we're moving to a multipolar economy. I, for one, don't think that this ends with Russia-Ukraine. I think Russia-Ukraine is a proxy war that's just the beginning of something much bigger between China, Russia, and United States. If that's right, it seems to me like the overall big picture game has changed of the world that we live in, and what's accessible that used to be a globalized economy is maybe no longer globalized, and you've got a compartmentalization of what happens within different economies around the globe. Do you agree with the high-level macro view that the world has changed, and if so, what are the implications on the cycles work that we've been talking about?
Oh, great, great question. Well, probably one of the best questions I've gotten in at least a year. So.
All year. That's the best one this year. I got to believe it.
Yeah, well, definitely best this year, but I'd say it in at least a year, man. Definitely agree with you. And I'll tell you why I agree with you. There's two separate reasons. So one, qualitatively, we can just look around and see that the world is splintering apart from a cooperation standpoint. Our friend over Jim Carson over Clive Volatility Advisors has a good sort of, kind of thought process around this, which is, you know, we're kind of in this world of resource scarcity. And the resource scarcity is creating sharp elbows around the dinner table amongst, you know, global powers, whether they be central banks, whether they be, you know, political leaders and kind of splintering apart from a cooperation standpoint, or whether they be cartels like OPEC, et cetera. So that's causing more inflation. Ultimately, that's not the only driver of what's causing more inflation. If you look at slide 68, we might have talked about this in our last interview, which is our secular inflation model. I think we have 16 or 17 features in this model that are ultimately designed to project the underlying stationary mean of core inflation. We're using core PCE as the dependent variable in this model. And the model, based on the deltas that we've observed decade to date, are showing or projecting that, hey, look, on the high end of that estimate range down there at the bottom, second to last row, you know, we're talking about core PCE that could trend around 3% in this decade. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of inflation, but if you consider the fact that core PCE trended at 1.6% in the prior decade, we're talking about almost double the amount of inflation on a core basis in this decade. So that's obviously a significant issue in the context of on slide 69, where we believe that treasuries, bonds, not just treasuries, I mean, this is global sovereign debt in general. I mean, don't forget, we had trillions of dollars of negatively yielding debt as recently as, you know, 16, 17, 18 months ago. So treasuries are extremely mispriced in a world where 3 to 5% inflation is the norm, because ultimately it could be closer to 5. If you go back to slide 68, where we see that commodities row there, that commodities row could easily be it's right now it's a 2.8 sigma delta adjusted Z score. You could be talking about a 6 sigma if you get some of these forecasts, some of these more aggressive forecasts on commodities right. So anyway, going back to slide 69, where we show term premium in the treasury market, you know, we're still negative term premium. You know, our work has shown in recent macro scouting reports, this is our monthly macro scouting report that we present to our clients. You know, in recent macro scouting reports, we've shown using data from my former professor at Yale, Bob Schiller, his data going back to the 1800s, where you look at the relationship between inflation volatility relative to economic volatility, and they're highly correlated. And more importantly, they're highly co-integrated with higher levels of inflation. So net, 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 higher inflation begets higher inflation volatility, and higher inflation volatility begets higher volatility in nominal and real economic growth. And ultimately, that's why you saw such a significant expansion, among other things, primary reason why you saw a significant expansion of term premium in the 1960s and 1970s is because of all that volatility. I mean, you think about what term premium are. Term premium are the physical manifestation of the volatility in economic forecasting. This is why, you know, term premium exists, because, you know, it's hard to forecast for extended periods of time, particularly when economic conditions are changing like they are right before our very eyes. And so the key, in my opinion, the number one most critical takeaway from this entire, you know, kind of uptick in inflation, the structural uptick in inflation, again, is likely to be, you know, in terms of core PCE, 50% more core PCE inflation this decade than we observed in the prior decade. That's an issue for the treasury market. It's an issue for global sovereign debt markets broadly. I'll start and just kind of isolate the treasury market, because I think a lot of these dynamics do extend to pretty much any developed market, sovereign debt market. If you look at slide 70, where we show treasuries, the total amount of marketable treasury securities held by all these major players, I'll start with the blue line. That's the Fed at $5.5 trillion. U.S. commercial banks at around $4 trillion in the red line. Foreign central banks right around $3.6 trillion in the black line. And then ultimately the residual of all that is the private sector, whether it be pension funds, hedge funds, households, et cetera, and obviously anyone who contributes to the private sector treasury holdings at rising pretty rapidly at just over $10 trillion. So effectively what's happening here, if you go to slide 71, is because governments have to sort of structurally fight inflation, you have foreign central banks selling inflation or selling treasuries, for instance, to defend their currencies. You have the Fed selling treasuries ultimately to shrink its balance sheet in conjunction with this monetary tightening regime, a regime that likely will be in place for an extended period of time. Don't think about the Fed put. Think about the Fed selling calls. And this is something we've talked about with investors, and I think we've talked about in your podcast as far back as last January. So ultimately, as a function of these major players selling treasuries, the private sector has to, basically take down greater and greater share of these marketable debt securities. And it's not just happening in the treasury market. We're seeing the ECB shrink its balance sheet, the Bank of England shrink its balance sheet, PBOC has shrunk its balance sheet as well in recent months. And ultimately, the Bank of Japan is really the only major central bank that is still expanding its balance sheet, obviously as a function of its yield curve control policy. So the key takeaway for all this, from my perspective, is twofold. One, this concept of 60-40 in a world that with structurally higher inflation is probably some version of dead. I don't want to say all the way dead because, again, we're likely to head into recession by the end of this year and you're going to see a rally in bonds. But ultimately, we're not going to see the kind of, aggressive rally in bonds that we've historically seen, because I think the market is going to be incrementally smarter about some of these debt sustainability dynamics from a supply and demand perspective. And ultimately, it's going to be kind of playing hot potato on who's willing to push the 10-year treasury yield below, say, 250 basis points in a recession scenario. That'd be a no-brainer if we were in the prior regime. But obviously, going much below that level from a yield perspective, puts the person who's putting that capital to work at risk in the context of the recovery in inflation, the recovery in nominal growth that we're likely to see on the other side of this recession we're forecasting. So that's number one. And number two, from a sector and style factor dispersion perspective, we've sort of lived in an era, if you go to slide 147, where we show the small cap to mega cap ratio, we sort of lived in an era in the past 10 years or so, maybe not quite 10 years, 8 years or so, of where it's really paid to bet on mega cap safety as a function of their ability to take those low interest rates and manufacture earnings, manufacture pretty much any cash flows, et cetera, with lower and lower interest rates. And that's been very favorable for mega caps relative to small caps. And more importantly, it's been extremely favorable to slide 148, extremely favorable to growth relative to value. So in our opinion, this kind of change, this regime shift, this structural regime shift from an investor and from a secular strategic asset allocation perspective is already underway, in our opinion, as a function of some of these debt sustainability dynamics, which themselves are a function of this sort of changing inflation regime that we're now in. So ultimately, it's you're betting on value relative to growth, you're betting on small caps relative to mega caps, you're betting on, if you go to slide 50, you're betting on emerging markets relative to developed markets, pretty much, it's cyclicals relative to defensives. It's all one big carry trade associated with, having higher inflation and ultimately interest rates that are just, quite frankly, sustainably structurally higher than they otherwise would have been in the prior Fed regime.
Darius, I want to come back to slide 68, where you're making this prediction that there could be potentially a 3.2% core PCE for the next decade. And, I look at your math here, and, you're considering demographics and velocity of money, and there's various different considerations. Okay, I get it. But what if I were to pull my crystal ball out, and this is not a prediction, but a speculation of what might be possible? What if I said that one of the trends of the 2020s might be the weaponization of inflation as a tool of monetary warfare, where the conflict grows between United States, Russia, and China, and you start to see China and Russia sort of saying, instead of the old regime where it's basically whatever we got that we can sell, we'll take the money, friend or foe, take the dough, we'll sell you whatever we've got if you want to buy it. They maybe change their strategy and say, What are the things where we could stop exporting in order to only give up a little bit of revenue that we could afford to live without that would really screw our enemy over a little bit and leave them in a situation where they're really hurting? And certainly energy comes into play there. I think that rare earth metals that are used to make the magnets for windmills and so forth could come into that equation. What if we were to see this multipolar global economy take a direction where inflation is weaponized and it's being caused intentionally by our trading partners as a tool of warfare? What does that do to your calculations and your outlook overall?
Well, I think that's a phenomenal sort of secondary follow-up question. I mean, just kind of going down the rows of this table, you know, you're going to wind up having is obviously a lot less automation as you have to reshore. I mean, everyone thinks reshoring is, it's kind of CapEx, R&D, and, you know, in tech, in order to build plants, you need people to put bricks together. You know, to my knowledge, I'm not sure that robots have been proven able to build plants and things of that nature. So we're going to have less automation as a share of the total economy in all of these geographies as a function of reshoring. Obviously, commodities would be through the roof, landing on Mars, not even the moon. In that scenario. So that's going to be quite positive in terms of the resulting inflation shock from your scenario here. Deglobalization, which is already contributing pretty significantly to the inflation, to uptick inflation in this model, will actually accelerate in that instance. I'm not so sure that, you know, we're ever going to get at least in the U.S., we're ever going to figure it out with respect to immigration. But generally in these periods of, you know, kind of intense global competition, border walls get raised. You know, it's not like, It's globalization is how you get immigration. So I'd imagine deglobalization would actually start to create negative aspects to that and from a household formation standpoint as well. You know, we can go on and on down this list. And ultimately, things like wages will be, you know, kind of a direct function of a lot of these different dynamics. You know, higher inflation getting higher wage demands, ultimately more demand for labor, creating higher wage demands. You know, the redundancy of supply chain just means you got to have more people doing more stuff. And it's just going to be less profitable from the perspective of corporate margins. And so ultimately, I think there's kind of one big key takeaway here from your question, which is, look, this era that we're heading into, both from a geopolitical standpoint, but also from a macro, you know, traditional macro cycle standpoint, favors, if you look at slide 52, favors a convergence of these two pretty big lines. You know, this relationship between labor and capital in the U.S. economy. And again, it's not just the U.S. economy. I'm highlighting the U.S. here. You'll see the same dynamics in Europe. You'll see the same dynamics in Japan. You know, this relationship between labor and capital, labor is the blue line, employee compensation as a percent of gross value added of corporate business. That's the broadest measure of revenues that we have in the economy for the corporate sector. And then corporate profits as a percent of GDP. You know, it's just been kind of a one-way ticket up for profits and a one-way ticket down for labor in this, you know, very aggressive era of deglobalization. And ultimately, the population is fighting back. They're going to continue to have incremental sort of bargaining power with respect to wages. They're going to have more flexibility with respect to who they work for, where they work for them, how they work for them. And ultimately, if you go to slide 19, you know, we have a belief that this post-COVID reduction in labor supply is likely permanent. If you look at the employment to population ratio, again, we're focusing on the U.S. economy because ultimately getting the Fed reaction function right is a lot more important to our jobs than getting the ECB reaction function right. But ultimately, a lot of this, you know, a lot of dynamics we can readily observe in the, you know, the European data, et cetera, et cetera. So just kind of humor me here, just take this and extrapolate this across most of the developed market, most of the G10. Employment to population ratio down 130 basis points, peak to present from the pre-COVID high. Same thing, down 130 basis points for the labor force participation rate. That is being driven primarily by a significant reduction in the labor force participation rate for older employees. I think people, you know, just from an anecdotal standpoint, I think if you're more at risk of dying from COVID, this new disease, but more importantly, you've probably seen, you know, some of your friends die. And you realize that, hey, look, you know, there's a lot of stuff you want to do in your life before you get out of here. So you're probably less apt to go wave at people at Home Depot. Or whatever it is that, you know, people do. And then lastly, with the female labor force participation rate is pretty structurally low as well. And I think, you know, anecdotally, you know, I use myself as an example. You know, I spent a decade living in, you know, right in the middle of Manhattan, kind of just being a young single bachelor, but now I'm an old married man. And I live in upstate New York now, which is where my wife is from. And in upstate New York, you know, it just doesn't cost nearly as much to live, you know, so we don't need two incomes. And I think a lot of folks who've moved out of cities in the pandemic, particularly millennials who are formulating households, they probably are experiencing a lot of similar dynamics. So from an inflation standpoint, it's kind of coming at us from all angles, which is we see a lot of people who've left the labor force for a variety of reasons. And oh, by the way, it's one last reason that I don't even have on this chart. But if you think about the decline in the prime working age labor force participation rate, which is the 24, 25 to 54 year olds, their labor force participation rate is still down, I want to say like 80 or 90 basis points from the pre-COVID high. And my hypothesis on why that is the case is just look at the growth of the gig economy. I mean, prior to 2020, we didn't have everyone delivering every single thing we could think about. Now we've got Amazon, we got Instacart, we got DoorDash, we got Uber, we got Uber Eats. Pretty much everything you do is being done by somebody who was not employed in the gig economy industry 2 to 3 years ago. And so ultimately, it just subtracts the total amount of people who are willing to go work at a, I don't know, Marriott or McDonald's or, Amtrak or whatever. I'm just picking up random companies out of that. But this is why costs are going up, because again, the competition for labor is very intense, in so much that the competition for resources is very intense, going back to that table on slide 68. So ultimately, it's going to be very hard for us to get out of this inflation problem. Again, going through a recession will temporarily alleviate the inflation problem, but ultimately we're going to still be stuck with a structurally higher level of wage and realized inflation, and as a function of that, an ultimately higher level of economic volatility that we have to deal with as investors.
Final question, Darius. We've talked about your outlook for economic cycles as well as the stock market. Let's talk about commodities, including gold. What's your outlook there?
I think gold is a pretty decent exposure here. Full disclosure, we're still dollar bulls right now, so I don't know that this is the best time to be allocating to gold in size. Just a comment I made on the dollar bull scenario. If you go to slide 72, this is a pretty complicated chart, but I think it's worth explaining why we're not so gung-ho on gold and yet so gung-ho on the euro, et cetera, at this particular juncture. The markets are already pricing in a preposterous amount of tightening by the ECB relative to the Fed. So what I'm showing in this chart here on slide 72 is the 1 year, 1 month euro overnight index swap spread versus the ECB deposit rate. And from that value, I'm subtracting that same value in dollar terms minus the Fed funds rate. So effectively, it's a measure of how much the market expects the ECB to tighten or ease relative to the Fed over the next year. And that number is currently 154 basis points. So the market effectively expects the ECB to hike 6 times more than they expect the Fed to hike over the next year. And that number is 202 basis points in the bottom panel for the next 2 years. So, you got a full 8 rate hikes by the ECB relative to the Fed. There's almost no scenario I can imagine in my head economically from a global economic standpoint where the ECB is able to hike 6 more times in the Fed over a one-year time frame, particularly from this starting point, which we're staring down the barrel of a global recession by the back end of this year. So in our opinion, we would be fading this aggressive policy tightening, which, by the way, is being reflected in the currency market. If you look at slide 142, real quick, the positioning in the euro is very aggressive. Positioning in euro, I want to say, is around the plus 21% net length. So that's a net long position of plus 21% relative to total open interest. That's 100 percentile reading on a one-year basis and an 86 percentile reading on an all-time basis. And so ultimately, the market is very much kind of long euro. It's also quite long gold, not as aggressive as the euro, but it's quite long gold here at plus 26%. So it's our belief that it's not likely that we have seen kind of the end of the dollar rally. I don't know that we're probably going back to the highs that we observed in kind of late October, early November. But ultimately, I do believe we'll probably get a better buying opportunity in gold and maybe foreign currencies vis-a-vis the dollar as a function of this kind of extension of the phase one liquidity cycle downturn, which, oh, by the way, if you go back to slide 73, if you look at Taylor rule spreads, the market seems to be kind of running away with this narrative that the ECB is going to be significantly more hawkish than the Fed. And ultimately, we're seeing that resulting in positioning. We're seeing that resulting in positioning in gold, et cetera, things that would be correlated to euro strength. If you look at the Taylor rule spread, so we're taking the 12-month T-bill yield or 12-month yield in each of these localities, US, Germany, UK, and Japan, and subtracting what the Taylor rule estimate for the policy rate should be in that locality. And as you can see, the US is still significantly more tight relative to the lackadaisical policy, rather, if you will, of the ECB and the Bank of England. you know, I guess the market is effectively saying, hey, look, that's going to compress significantly. But as you, again, going back to slide 72, it's already compressed in market expectations terms. So it's unclear to me how it's going to significantly compress from here in terms of supporting the euro and supporting things that will be positively correlated to the euro. So sorry, that's an extremely long-winded macroeconomist answer to your very simple question on do we like gold. I think from a medium to longer-term perspective, no doubt it's going to be very difficult for real interest rates to rise considerably from here. And ultimately, we do believe gold has significant value as a store value in this kind of breaking apart the splintering of this kind of global economic world that we've kind of lived in for the last kind of 30 to 40 years. But ultimately, I still think, you know, maybe the better time to allocate to that is when we personally feel a lot more comfortable allocating to bonds and ultimately, you know, kind of betting on a significant decline in real interest rates, which ultimately I believe is likely to be more associated with the phase two credit cycle downturn rather than what we are currently experiencing, which is still in the phase one liquidity cycle downturn. So we will be buying gold in size at some point this year. I just don't think it's the right time to do it now.
Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview and particularly for a terrific slide deck. I think you get the record at 150 pages of really data-rich graphs and charts. You do a terrific job, and I know that you update this slide deck periodically for the benefit of your subscribers. Please tell our listeners a little bit more about 42 Macro, what you do there, what it takes to get the subscription, to get updates of this chart, and what else is included in that subscription.
Yeah, thanks again, Eric. I appreciate you for having me on. You're right. This is our what we call our macro scouting report. It's one of our key products. So we publish a deck like this every month at the beginning of every month. It's not this particular same deck. It's whatever we think is relevant to helping investors contextualize and ultimately profit from macro cycle risk. And we're very explicit about the bets we make from a portfolio and asset allocation standpoint. If you go to slide five in this deck, we just have a stylized example of our portfolio construction, which, by the way, in the raging cross-asset bear market where the S&P was down 20, NASDAQ down 33, TLT down 33, Bitcoin, Ethereum down 60 to 70%, you know, this portfolio construction process here on slide five only lost 334 basis points. Again, I use this to trade my entire liquid net worth. And so I'm very proud of that. But more importantly, I'm very proud of the work that we put in on a daily, weekly, monthly basis to help investors stay abreast of these macro cycles. So again, thanks for the opportunity to present. And as always, you know, look forward to reconciling this in a little bit.
We look forward to getting you back for an update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, was great to have Darius back on the show. Now, joining us again in the postgame is Nick Galarnik. Now, Eric, what did you take away from the interview with Darius?
I agree with Darius that the bottom is probably not in for the S&P. I'll be very surprised if it is. I don't really have a strong opinion about the timing of when that's going to occur. If Darius says it's more likely to happen in the second half of the year, I'll certainly be patient and wait it out.
Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Darius's picture that says looking for the downloads. All right, Nick, let's get to some of these charts. On page two, we have the S&P 500. I'm curious at what levels you're watching here.
Yeah, so looking at the S&P here, spot right now is about 3880 or so. For the January 20th OPEX, plus minus 140 points on the expected move, the upside there is 4,000, which is also a key level of resistance. The downside there is 3,700, which also happens to be a key level of support, with 3,500 being the next level of heavy support back from the October lows. What are you thinking on these markets here, Eric?
I don't have any strong conviction short-term. As far as medium to long-term, I do not think that the final low is in for the bear market, and I still think that less than 3,000 on the S&P is very possible before this is over. But before that happens, I really have no strong conviction as to what happens in the short-term.
Interesting perspectives. Like for me, when I look at that S&P 500, I think we're actually at a very critical pivot. this 3,800 that was the lows throughout the holiday season, to me, line up with a perfect Fib zone. And essentially, we have a really important decision that the markets are going to make on the jobs numbers and next week's inflation numbers is, will we be breaking those 3,800 lows? The way I look at it is, you can almost use it as a pivot where the market has the upside still open for another push to retest its December high if 3,800 holds. But if for whatever reason the news is interpreted bearishly and starts a sell cycle below 3,800, we go right down to that level that you mentioned there, Nick, which was down near the 3,500 lows. But the interesting thing to me, though, is that that was where the NASDAQ is trading. So let's move on here to the Qs. And Nick, like one of the things I'm looking at here is that if the S&P breaks 3,800, that would almost certainly push the NASDAQ to a lower low. And that could in itself start a feedback loop of selling that creates some liquidity. What levels are you watching on the Qs?
Yeah, all valid points there. For me, I'm looking at different levels. The upside here, so again, looking at the January 20th OPEX, does not factor in earnings at all. Keep in mind, earnings will start late January for big tech especially. So I think Apple reports the week of the 27th, I believe. But right now for the Qs, the spot is 366, plus or minus 13 points by January 20th on the expected moves. The upside here is 280, which is also a key level of resistance. The downside here is 253, which is just below that October low of 254. Now, again, we're seeing a lot of negative sentiment in the tech sector right now. Yesterday, Amazon laid off 1% of their workforce, and Salesforce laid off 10% of their workforce. So we're seeing a lot of layoffs here, which could also boost EPS in the short term as expenses go down, obviously. But again, we have late January, early February earnings coming out very soon, and that will dictate where we go in the short term. Keep in mind, we have the pre-COVID 2020 highs of 236, which are the next key levels of support if we break below 250 on the Qs.
All right, so moving on to page four, we have the VIX. And what I'm actually surprised, well, I'm not totally surprised, Nick, that the VIX stayed relatively low pricing in that kind of trade range price action of the holiday season. But here we are in January, and certainly the market is poised in the first quarter to have some volatility. So watching the VIX for signals, I think, is really important. For me, anyway, that 25 level is a very important pivot, because if we, for instance, had, like we were saying, the NASDAQ break to a lower low, S&P break below 3,800, and at the same time, the VIX is spiking north of 25. To me, that is demonstrating that the market is in some sort of a bigger sell cycle. Do you see it the same way, or what levels are you watching on the VIX?
Again, as I said in the past, the key levels I'm watching are the 20 level and the 25 level. If you get below 20, obviously lower volatility. 25 is a key level I'm looking at, where if we break above that, we'd see a lot more volatility and a possible spike to 35 or so. But again, to me, isn't that surprising that we're seeing the VIX kind of stay in this lower range? Because if you look at the past 2 weeks of price action on the S&P, we've seen a very, very narrow range on the S&P. Since basically December 16th, we've sat between 3890 on the upside and on the downside, 3764. So about 130, 140 point range roughly. And we've just bobbed around in that area for the past 2 weeks. So not surprising at all, the VIX hasn't really elevated too much. But again, I'm watching the put to call interest right now, which is 0.44. And nothing really crazy there that I'm seeing. But I do want to look at the 25 level. If it does break that, I do expect a push to 30 or 35, and that could coincide with CPI or the next FOMC or also the next earnings season. Now, moving on to the US dollar on page five, Eric, has anything changed in your thinking?
The downsloping short-term channel has now been broken, so to my eye, this is now a sideways consolidation as opposed to a downtrend. But I have no strong view as to what comes next in the short to medium term. Longer term, I found Zoltan Poser's year-end piece anticipating serious efforts from both Russia and China to end dollar hegemony fascinating. So was that peak that we just saw at 116 on the Dixie a few months ago, was that the final peak before the Luke Groman moment where the dollar, you know, finally loses its hegemony over the global economy and goes into permanent decline? Or do we still have higher to go on the dollar, as Darius suggested in today's feature interview. Jury's still out in my mind, but I highly recommend Zoltan's year-end piece for listeners because the insights that it contained around what the ramifications of a multipolar geopolitical landscape will be on the dollar longer term, I found to be absolutely fascinating.
And my views on the dollar are somewhat on a bullish tilt, which is I don't see that much more further short-term downside on the dollar. Like, we've already seen a 2,000 pip drop in the U.S. dollar yen and some pretty extraordinary bounces back in the euro. At this stage, I don't see those trends continuing in a big way. Obviously, there's always room for a couple hundred pip moves, but I think the next big move is actually a U.S. dollar rebound. And what to me, if the dollar was to start rallying, it would probably be an environment where the bigger macro story is risk off. And it'll be really interesting to see whether the inner markets all line up that way. Now, moving on to page six, I just wanted to quickly touch on crude oil. I know, Eric, you had a pretty extensive breakdown of your views, and really it's showing that big 10% drop in 2 days that we saw in crude. But what was to me was important was the fact that we have not yet seen legitimate bullish price action in oil. Now, while in the bigger picture, I remain somewhat optimistic and bullish oil, there clearly is no sign technically that a new accumulation cycle has begun. We continue to see this pattern of lower highs and lower lows, and every short-term bounce is immediately met with new rounds of selling. This time around, what will be really interesting to see is whether or not the previous low around 70-72 holds as and starts establishing a base, or whether we have another full leg lower, which could measure easily down towards $65 down on crude. And so I'll be watching closely whether these support lines hold, but nothing really bullish to say here on crude.
Let's move on to gold on page seven. Eric, what are your thoughts on this breakout?
It's hard not to love gold here, but caution is warranted just in the sense that the upper trend line resistance in place since early November has been tested and rejected five times now. That resistance level is currently 1877, but the number goes up every day. My point is simply not to chase it right at the top of the channel, right along that trend line. There's no clear parallel trend line support, but the 21-day moving average has been the best indicator of support that I see on the chart, and it's currently down at 1815. So I'd wait for a dip before putting new money to work on the long side of gold here, but overall the uptrend seems to be intact, and it seems to be progressing nicely. We had been in a sideways consolidation towards the end of last year. I was wondering if it was maybe about to roll over. Looks like we're seeing the upside resolution to that consolidation, so let's see if it holds.
Eric, I totally get your views on gold, but for me, I actually, on the short term, think that this gold move has more or less run out its course. I don't see, at least in my initial approach here, that we're going to make a big breakout yet to the previous highs. To me, this was a very oversold market, and as the dollar index did its correction, it alleviated the pressure on gold and allowed it, to, like a cross currency, to have a mean reverting rally. The big thing for me here is I'll be watching whether or not some sort of a correction in gold starts to happen below 1900. I don't think that gold is necessarily going to go all the way back to its previous lows, but on the short term, I anticipate that gold is going to probably put in a short-term swing high. I don't think that changes a big picture view of how investors should be positioned on gold, but it's certainly, I think, not a tactical moment to be chasing gold higher here.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Darius' slide deck. You'll also find the link to the chart deck we just discussed here in the postgame, and a link to a number of articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases, and also follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.